Hello and welcome to the Breaking Canon podcast. I'm James Callahan.
I'm Julius Freeman.
And I'm Joel Saito.
This week on the show, we're kicking off a brand new series covering the Back to the Future trilogy, beginning with a discussion of the 1985 original, written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, and directed by Robert Zemeckis. Julius, take us back in time to your first experience with Back to the Future and tell us if you think the film still holds up.
Yes, it still holds up. And I remember when I watched this as a kid and seeing the intro, you know, seeing the machines opening up dog food and or like the eggs being put in the pan. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, what is this? I'm already interested in this, whatever this is. And then here comes the, you know, Marty, his feet and the skateboard and everything. And then he turns on this big old amp and then slowly, you know, raises up and then gets the strum of the guitar, I guess flies out. And then after that, I was like, oh, man, I don't know what this is, but I'm in. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm all about it.
Yeah.
And a great intro that still it held up. When I watched it again last night, I was like, I started laughing. I was like, man, sorry, I just forgot how good this movie is.
It's so good.
I can't wait to talk about it.
Was this the first time you'd watched it in a while?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Okay.
I know this movie like the back of my hand. It's kind of like my... Yeah. So you know how like Jules talked about how Terminator 2 was his childhood staple movie? So Back to the Future is definitely mine. That movie I watched over and over. Like I said, I know it like the back of my hand. So when I watched it again, I just... All these like childhood memories started floating back. And I was remembering like, man, this movie was so exciting. And like... It never gets old, never gets boring.
It never gets old and never gets boring. Yeah, it's this movie's like comfort food. That's kind of the conclusion I came to. Jules, tell me about your history with this movie.
This is one of those movies like we've talked about it before when we did like Indiana Jones, where it's like there was always Star Wars, Indy, and Back to the Future were like
the Holy Trinity.
The Holy Trinity of movie trilogies.
Yep.
And when you're a kid, at least like growing up, when we were growing up, it was like those three were the thing, three movie series that everyone knew about and everyone watched and everyone was in love with. This kind of fell into a similar category as Indy for me as a kid, because I watched it once when I was a kid, and I don't know, for whatever reason, it didn't capture me the way like Star Wars did or Terminator did. And so I hadn't, you know, I kind of like was like whatever about it and didn't rewatch it until I don't know, maybe like high school or like sometime later when I finally watched like 1, 2 and kind of 3. You know, this is a movie for me that every time I watch, unlike Indy, every time I watch this movie, I actually gain a newfound appreciation for it. And I start to appreciate it more with every viewing. And this most recent rewatch a couple nights ago, I was like fully enamored by this movie.
Hell yes. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, it's fucking great, it man. Is. This is like a great movie. I think like as a kid, for me at least, it disappointed me because it was like just by the title, you're kind of expecting it to be like this like sci-fi future.
Yeah, right,
like,
right.
You know, thing. And like you don't get that until the second movie. Mm-hmm. And this one, it's like he's going back to the 50s and you know, hanging out in like fucking like, you know, malt shops and so there was like, I think as a kid, there was like this disconnect for me where I was just like, well, what the fuck? Like, this isn't what I want to watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not until like I watched it like, you know, the 3 or 4 times since where I start to like really appreciate the storytelling of this movie, because it's an incredibly tight movie. Yeah. Like the script is phenomenal.
It's one of I mean, whenever I like think of my favorite of all time, you know, screenplay, I immediately think of this one. You know, whether or not it's the best ever written, I mean, it's kind of beside the point. It's just like it, as an example of a perfectly structured film. This is you don't get better than this, pretty much.
Yeah,
everything about this movie. It's like Every scene is great. I can't think of a single scene in this that I would, you know, not want to have in this movie. Some of it is dated, sure, but like any movie from 1985 is going to be dated in some way. I had a similar experience as a kid because when I was first exposed to this movie, I remember really loving it, but I remember kind of like Indiana Jones as a young kid being confused about which parts belong to which movie, because I had familiarity with the second and third one, not as much as the first. But in preparation for this episode, I went on YouTube and I rewatched a YouTube clip of The Ride at Universal Studios.
Oh, yeah.
And realized like that also had kind of like been a part of my headcanon of Back to the Future. So it wasn't until I would say like maybe within the last 10 years or so, I finally revisited these movies. And, you know, I watched Back to the Future and was like, oh, this is the one I'm the most, you know, familiar with. And then the second and third one, I was like, okay, these ones I think I watched maybe once or twice as a kid and never really loved them that much. But I remember distinctly as a kid loving Back to the Future so much, just thinking it was a blast to watch. And most movies that were this old, I didn't really like that much. I would rather watch a newer film. And yeah, I mean, this one is, it's a film that like, I feel like has aged beautifully. You know, it feels like now I have the same reaction as you, Jules, where whenever I rewatch this, I end up liking the movie more somehow, which is, I can't say that about a lot of childhood favorites. Not a lot of them mm-hmm. have aged this well, where I feel like they somehow get better with age.
You don't think Howard the Duck aged well, James?
Listen, I just saw that movie. Maybe I'll feel differently in like a year or two. So, you know, maybe we'll do a Howard the Duck rewatch. But yeah, I mean, it's such a... rewatching it last night, I was also reminded of how funny this movie is.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it is hilarious. It is such a funny movie. I've never seen it in a theater before, but I'm kind of curious to see how this plays to a you know, a big full audience, because I feel like it's such a crowd pleaser, you know. So let's talk a little bit about that opening, Julius, because you mentioned the machine, right?
Yeah.
Which is called a Rube Goldberg machine.
Oh, okay.
And I love the fact that the movie opens with one of these, because I feel like it kind of encapsulates the way this movie is plotted. The whole movie itself is kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it really is. And that's kind of the way I've looked at this movie kind of in recent years, and just like the plot mechanics of it, which I find so fascinating, with all like the setup and the payoff and the different like visual gags and the Easter eggs, things that are kind of dropped in the beginning and then paid off later in the movie. It has that kind of Rube Goldberg, you know, machine feel. And I want to talk a little bit about just like the plotting of this movie, because I just think it's fascinating, like how well constructed it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you can tell a lot of care went into this screenplay.
Absolutely.
Obviously, it dealt with time travel. And like, as we discussed with the Terminator series, it's tough to do time travel movies because of the very thing of like continuity and mm-hmm. making sure you don't confuse the audience too much. And this, I thought, was absolutely pitch perfect. Especially when you mentioned the intro, how like they kind of gave you clues as to what to expect later in the movie.
Right. Yeah, right.
Definitely. Yeah. The whole movie is just a masterclass in setup and payoff.
Yeah. Yes.
Because throughout the movie, I was noticing like, especially this time watching it, everything that happens in this movie, every scene, every moment, every action that the characters take, everything the characters say, ends up becoming a setup mm-hmm. for something that gets paid off later on. It's a movie that's wastes little to no mm-hmm. time or space on anything unnecessary, and it works so perfectly. It really is like a Rube Goldberg machine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the whole movie is just a whole series of like satisfying Chekhov's guns that just get like fired in every few intervals and like perfectly spaced out. Like everything that like gets brought up by the mom, by Leah Thompson, in the first act is comes back in one way or another later on. Yeah. It's so perfectly executed.
Yeah, it kind of makes me giddy. And I mean, that might be why I think the film has aged so well for me, is that like The more you delve into the mechanics of this movie, the more you realize like they thought of everything. And it's like, it's not even an, you know, it's not an academic experience at all. It's such a blast to watch this movie. Like the humor in it is so fun. And you know, this is a movie, you know, kind of like Star Wars and Raiders, where I revisit it frequently and it never gets old. I feel like I could watch this movie like, you know, a few times a year and not get sick of it. Very few films like that. And I think part of it is because of the mastery of the construction of this movie. You know, it's one of those movies where when you watch it, you know, like if it's on TV or if you just happen to put it on, you can't shut it off. You're yeah. just like, oh, I want to see the next scene. I'll just wait till this scene. And you keep going until the movie's over, basically.
Well, what I like the most about it personally was the human element behind it, too. Like the idea of knowing your parents when they were teenagers.
Right.
Always fascinated me. Even when I was a kid, like when I first watched the movie, I remember just thinking like, wow, what the hell my mom and my dad would have been like as teenagers. That's very interesting. Now, of course. I don't want what to happen to Marty when he went back in time.
Yeah.
Right. That was freaking terrible.
Nobody wants that.
I would like to observe from far away and just kind of watch, you know, but to be engaged with your mom come like trying really hard to get you. It's like, it was just one of those things that made the movie, even though a little strange, still like funny. Like they managed to make it funny. Yeah. You know, which is very hard to do.
I mean, at least they didn't go all the way like in Futurama.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it really is this premise. And I think it's also the fact that, you know, this is a premise that I think anybody would be interested in, you know, kind of as the movie starts to reveal itself and reveal exactly what it's going to do. And as your like excitement starts to kind of grow, it completely builds on the promise of that premise throughout the entire movie, you know? And I think that, you know, there's so many movies out there that might squander a good premise or not completely pay it off. But this is one that takes like something that I think is pretty universal. Like everybody, you know, would want to have an experience like this where they could like go back in time and, you know, see where their family
came
from.
Get hit on by your mom.
And enter this Freudian nightmare where your dad is a coward and your mom wants to fuck you. Like, yeah.
Your pants on her hope chest.
Yeah. And apparently, yeah, that was the, I guess the, where this idea came from with Bob Gale was, I guess, looking through a yearbook of his dad's and seeing that his dad was class president and thinking like, would we have hung out in high school? Would my dad have been my friend, you know? And the movie just kind of grew out of that. And you mentioned like the human element of the story. I feel like this is a much more, this is a comedy first and a, you know, human comedy first, high concept one. All of the sci-fi in this movie is bogus in a way that I think it's like very tongue in cheek about. Like, I love the part where Doc says like, oh, if you want to go to the signing of the Declaration of Independence or the birth of Christ and it's December 25th, year zero. But there's like so many moments of that where I think that the movie just kind of reveals that, you know, the sci-fi is ridiculous in this movie. Don't try to like, you know, don't try to work it out.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. As it should be. That's the way a good popcorn film anyway should be.
Right.
Not let you linger on the idea, just go with the ride, go with it, and just enjoy it. And they did a great job with the stakes too. The fact that he was stuck in 1955, which made the movie even more like lured you in and what made you want to watch until the end.
Not only stuck, but with the added like danger of possibly not existing anymore
because
he fucked with the timeline, which is like a fantastic like bit of world building or like building in some rules to the time travel.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like something that I think we criticized a bit with some of the Terminator movies, especially some of the later Terminator movies, where it's like they've either created a paradox or they've created a bunch of timelines and it doesn't matter, or, you know, it just in all these like, you know, the paradox just like hurts your head to think about. Like this one, they like keep it simple. They establish the rules. It's like you fuck with the timeline and it's going to have consequences to your immediate self.
Yeah.
like, you know, he starts disappearing. Like, yeah. He looks at his hand and his hand's like slowly mm-hmm. like fading away. Mm-hmm. Like, there's like these things that they set up that, like, yeah, it's kind of bogus sci-fi, but at the same time, it's like within the rules that they set up for their own world, mm-hmm. it all makes sense.
Yes.
And you know the rules of it and you know the consequences of messing with the timeline when you go back in time.
And even having something as ingenious as like a picture to keep referring to see like the status of the stakes, basically, you know, my sister's half gone. You know, that means I better, you know, pick up the pace here. This viewing, I also was wondering too, is the picture basically insinuating that in the future, his brother and sister are just like slowly losing limbs? And are they interacting with their family as they're losing their limbs? Because Marty just kind of starts to become transparent, right? So, yeah, I mean, right. I can't imagine how horrifying that would be in like 1985.
Oh my gosh.
You know, where that's happening.
Little things from your bedroom start disappearing. You're like, what's going on? What's happening? Right.
What if he like looked at the picture at one point in the movie and it's like now all of a sudden it's like the photo of Sarah Connor in the truck.
It is very interesting that like we kind of subconsciously slotted Back to the Future in after Terminator, the Terminator series, because I mean they both deal with time travel, you know, of course this one more explicitly,
and they both deal with like the birth of a main character.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Whether or not they will exist or not.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Same stakes.
Yeah. And it's something, you know, even though the stakes in this movie are like very clearly communicated and it is suspenseful in the sense that you're just like, you know, obviously you don't want Marty to disappear. You want him to go back to the future and save his family and all of that. But there's never a moment where I feel like there's like tension necessarily. This movie's very light on its feet. It will always sacrifice tension for like a fun visual gag or a joke. Yeah. And that's actually something I really love about this movie and makes it so watchable is that, yeah, I never feel like stressed out when I'm watching this movie at all. I just feel like it's a fireworks show and a ride. Yeah. When you hit the end of this movie, like the clock tower sequence goes on way longer than it has any right to be. It's just like milking every ounce of you know, tension out of it as it's happening. But it just feels more like it makes it that more satisfying when, you know, the DeLorean finally disappears, you know, and they succeed. And again, that Rube Goldberg machine aspect of this movie kind of like working itself out. Tell me a little bit about your guys' history with Robert Zemeckis. Is this a director that you guys like a lot?
I did, yes. You know, when I got to my senior year in high school, I started looking into like the names of the directors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Forrest Gump was one of my favorite movies mm-hmm. when it first came out. And when I found out it was the guy who did Back to the Future, I was like, oh, wow, this guy's really, really good. You know, like,
yeah,
it's kind of like a Spielberg. And of course, this is long before I knew any history regarding like Hollywood and the industry and what have you. But yeah, I always thought Robert Zemeckis was always a great entertaining director, kind of like in the same likes as Spielberg or
definitely, yeah.
Who was the guy who directed Gremlins? What was his name?
Was it Joe Dante or
Joe Dante? Yeah.
Okay.
I kind of had like a Joe Dante vibes when I would watch a Zemeckis film.
Yeah.
Like, of course, Zemeckis would be a little bit more
more elevated,
more fantastical.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, he was definitely one of my favorites. Because he also had a good eye for casting the right actors for his. For his films, at least in the first half of his career. The second half, well, it's a little
yeah.
shaky, but the first half of his career definitely had a good eye for casting. I mean, Eric Stoltz almost was in the movie, and
Eric Stoltz was actually in the movie for
like a second, right?
For a while, for like a good amount of the filming, they had to go and reshoot everything.
Yeah,
yeah, and because they recognized it didn't work, and that's the part of the. You know, I would imagine that's so hard to do. You're already shooting. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're like, dude, this guy is not working out. Like, we need to recast. We need Michael J. Fox, damn it.
And Zemeckis wanted Michael J. Fox. I guess him and Bob Gale were like, the only option was Michael J. Fox. They couldn't see anybody else in the role. And so I don't know if anybody else really would have worked.
No way. Real bummer for
Eric Stoltz.
Well, from what I read, his approach was more dramatic.
Yeah. It was way more serious.
So I would imagine it wouldn't have worked. No way. Because the chemistry that Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd have, in this film are it's so impeccable. It's so perfect. You can't replace Marty, Michael J. Fox or Christopher Lloyd in those roles. No way.
Yeah. I so wish that we could somehow see the Eric Stoltz shots or the Eric Stoltz scenes, because some of those stories are so funny. Like, he's like, he walks on the set and he's like, in a scene, he's like talking about like talking to Bob Zemeckis about like, oh, like what the, you know, it's such a sad, tragic story. Like, you know, the implications of time travel are so intense. And it's just like, bro, it's a fucking comedy.
Oh, man.
Your meanwhile, mom is Crispin trying to have Glover. Sex with you. This is comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, like, Crispin Glover's like refusing to walk through doors and shit.
It's
like, the stories of like the production on this movie are so hilarious.
It really is insane. I mean, I tried to find as much footage as I could in prep for this episode, and there's very little footage of Eric Stoltz as Marty. And there are pictures that exist, of course, and it's kind of remarkable how much he looks like Michael J. Fox in a way, especially, you know, when you look at some of the, you know, production stills from when Stoltz was in the movie.
He definitely looked the part, but it was a matter of.
Right. Yes. He just didn't act it. And then you look at someone like Michael J. Fox. And I mean, I don't have a lot of memories of Family Ties, but I know it was a show that was on a lot as a kid.
Right.
And I just remember loving Michael J. Fox. Like, he was the best, you know, specifically because of this movie. I thought he was like the coolest person ever. But yeah, I mean, like, I remember just his, like, you know, his charm and his charisma, his comedic timing, his physical comedy. And like, all of that is evident in this movie. He's so good in this film.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's kind of the closest thing to a straight performance that this movie has, because every other performance in this is just like wildly over the top, you know? And
but it works, though. It still works within the confines of the film.
It works
in
this movie for sure.
And the makeup was well done, too. The way they made him look older.
I love it. I love the old age makeup. I love the fact that
they've
got
like, look like they're old.
They do. And the performances are great. Like, I mean, it's very weird to me that like Christopher Lloyd's performance is somehow not the weirdest performance in this movie. That it's Crispin Glover, who is so bizarre in this movie that I think it's a riot. I think he is so funny in this movie. He's clearly clearly in a different movie in his head. He's just not.
Clearly
I don't know
in a
what movie he's
world.
In.
Yeah,
right. A different world for sure. And what's the name of the actor who played Biff? Because he was also fantastic.
Oh, Thomas Wilson.
Thomas Wilson. Kudos to Thomas Wilson, man. Like he was the best cinematic villain. He's up there. He's up there in like all-time greats.
He is an absolute repulsive piece of shit. But he is so funny in this movie, and he's so good at playing a piece of shit. Oh my god, it's a great performance.
Why'd you tell me there was a blind spot in the car? And I especially love how he tells Marty, "What are you looking at, buddy? And see how your mom." I was like, "You fucking asshole! You're so good."
So before we get into like the time travel and all of that, I just wanted to ask you guys if you have like a like your own headcanon theory as to how Marty and Doc met.
You know, I thought about that for years. I was like, how in the hell does a high schooler meet a crazed, wild-eyed scientist like Doc Brown?
Yeah,
it would have to be by like crazy accident, like a serendipity type of like moment where they just like they were just destined to just meet. Maybe he was like messing around with the camera and skateboarding, and like Doc was like, "Hey, you kid, come over here.
Yeah, I need someone to
record
my
science. Record me with my experiments."
This is a relationship that, like, if you saw it now, you'd like raise some eyebrows.
Oh, totally, absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Like this old reclusive man, like with crazy hair, hanging out with a high school kid, a good looking high school kid.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like, well, what are they up to?
Well, in prep for this episode, I noticed I was paying extra attention, and I did notice that Doc's truck, his work truck, says 24-hour science services. So he has some kind of business that he runs while he's trying to, you know.
Science services.
Yeah, I don't know necessarily what that means. Whoa. So I was wondering if maybe Marty is like his assistant. And then they developed a friendship and a bond over time, because like their relationship in this movie is like, it's very unique, but it's very sincere. And what I've grown to love about this movie over time is that friendship. I think the friendship at the center of this movie, and I think part two and part three really like expand on this and add to this. But I really love their friendship at the center of this.
Yeah, I know they mentioned briefly in the movie that he spent his whole entire family fortune on the time machine. So maybe his name was still in Hill Valley anyway. Mm-hmm. A very prominent name, and maybe that's why people were like, well, you know, he's harmless, he's the local crazy scientist, it's all right, you know, he's spending his family's fortune. Because you see, I like how in 1985 when Marty leaves Doc's place, it's like in a parking lot and it's like one little piece left, and then when he goes back to 1955, it's this big old huge mansion on the hill. They totally cut down this mansion to like a piece of the garage. It's so crazy.
They built a Burger King where his mansion used to be.
I was like, damn, dude, you truly did spend your family's fortune.
Which,
by the way, the DeLorean time machine, badass. I mean, how cool is that?
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about that intro to that. I mean, it's like that in the Millennium Falcon for like, you know, movie vehicles, movie ships, whatever. It's the most amazing looking thing ever. It's so cool.
Yeah. It's like a, you know, it was always like a really cool looking car.
Yeah.
And then just to like, to take that and turn it into a time machine. It's genius.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like to, you know, with the gull wing doors and everything, like it, you know, come on. Like it's so cool. It's such a cool choice.
And it has that kind of like, it looks futuristic in a 1980s futuristic way. And that's what I love about this entire movie is that it's very much a time capsule. It's not trying to be like forward thinking at all. It's very much a 1985 film. And, you know, we might like think, you know, a time machine and a DeLorean is very quaint in 2023, but this was like the coolest looking thing ever. You know, even when I was a kid, I was like enamored with this thing. It was the most distinctive thing ever. You know, you saw a DeLorean, you immediately think Back to the Future, you know.
Yeah.
And apparently it was originally supposed to be a fridge and a pickup truck.
They kind of changed their mind.
They like almost went into production with that. I think the DeLorean was like a kind of somewhere in pre-production. They changed it to
that's
the DeLorean.
Like a wild concept to suddenly change from a refrigerator to a car. It was like apparently just out of like convenience of shooting, because like they needed to transport it. And like having to like transport a fridge in a giant truck. Or like having Doc Brown transport a giant fridge in like a truck, like involved him needing a bigger car. So they're like, oh, well, okay, what if he just drives a DeLorean? It's like, but then
sometimes
like
that's all
like,
it takes.
It's also like built so firmly into like the plot of the movie.
Yeah.
You know? Like there's so many moments where it's like involves the driving of this DeLorean. That like it's so hard to like imagine what the script was before that, where it's like, you know, does the fridge like fly into the barn at the beginning of the scene? Like, does he drag does he drag the fridge to like
to
where his
house.
Like house is to Doc's house? You know, like, and then, like, do they just like try to rig the fridge to be, I don't know, on top of the clock tower or whatever? Although it was like originally supposed to be like an atomic bomb test, right?
It was, I think it was a nuclear facility or maybe an atomic bomb testing site. And I guess just to save money, they were like, oh, we already built like, you know, Hill Valley in, you know, on the Universal Studios lot, so let's just do the climax at the clock tower. And so, I mean, it's weird for a movie that's so tightly constructed to be so malleable, you know, that they could just be like, oh, we'll just rearrange this and it still completely works, you know. It's a testament to this script.
Yeah, and a lot of the best stuff comes from like those changes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, not the same movie without it, you know.
Like changing from a fridge to a DeLorean is iconic.
Yeah.
Changing from like just like, you know, it could have been like a new like the opening of Indiana Jones 5 or 4.
Yeah.
Whatever,
with
like the nuclear test
with
site
in
and
the
refrigerator.
Yeah.
But instead we get like the iconic like clock tower lightning strike with like the electricity coming down the wire. Like it's iconic, you know, like
absolutely.
It works so perfectly because it's like, it's a clock tower, you know? Like,
It fits thematically with the entire movie and including, you know, the opening scene with all the different clocks and stuff and Harold Lloyd hanging from, you know, one of the little
callback
clocks.
To that with like Doc Brown hanging from the clock tower. It's interesting how well it works just based on like happenstance and convenience of filming.
It's an interesting thing about Zemeckis, who I think has had a very interesting career. I haven't really liked much of anything he's done in a couple of decades at least, but he's done some interesting stuff, you know, in that period. But in the lead up to doing this series, I rewatched Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and you know, rewatching the Back to the Future movies, watching Roger Rabbit, it made me appreciate this kind of like cartoonish phase of Zemeckis's career, where, you know, he wasn't either, you know, trying to be a more prestige filmmaker. You know, I think maybe winning an Oscar for Forrest Gump kind of like changed his career trajectory a little bit, or, you know, what he was going to be like pursuing. And I think his movies got a little bit more prestige-y at that point. But man, like, I mean, he was one of the most inventive filmmakers of the 80s and 90s, from like, you know, Back to the Future, I think probably all the way to Castaway.
We might not have Avatar if it weren't for Polar Express, James, and
this is true.
Advancements in mocap.
Yeah. Cameron saw the prequels and he saw Beowulf and he's like, okay, I'm gonna do it like that, just good.
And I'm gonna take my time. Sweet time.
Yeah, exactly.
I got $2 billion in the bank. All right.
People aren't aware that Jim Camp's favorite movie of all time is Bob Zemeckis's A Christmas Carol.
That was the movie that made him realize Avatar was possible, you know?
Yeah. He's like this, but in on Pandora.
Yep. So when Marty like enters 1955 Hill Valley, and it's, you know, very obviously the Universal, you know, Universal lot and all of that, I feel like this is kind of like on the same level of Dorothy walking out into Oz. You know, it's a moment where you're just like, oh shit, anything is possible at this point. One of the things that I love so much about this movie is that once Marty goes back in time, there's definitely some choices he makes along the way that complicate his journey into the past. You know, like if he hadn't had coffee or if he hadn't sat down at that at the diner next to his dad, he wouldn't have had to worry about, you know, getting in the way of his dad peeping, you know, being a peeping Tom and all of that. And then you wouldn't really have, you know, the movie. Yeah, I think it's so great because at that point, it's just like now you're paying off the entire first act, you know, all of act two is paying off all of the setup in act one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just a side note, I love the line the little kid told dad, he already mutated into human form, kill it.
Oh, my God. It's so funny.
Then, yeah, all of act two sets up, or act two sets up everything that was set up in act one, but then it just sets up everything that's just going to get paid off in act three. It's like,
exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's a perfectly constructed movie. And like the plotting of it is so tightly done.
Yeah.
I would imagine it's like crazy having dinner with your grandparents and your mom when they were like, you know, young, way younger. And your mom is like caressing your leg and he's looking for John F. Kennedy Drive. And the dad was like, who the hell is John F. Kennedy?
It was just who the hell is that?
the whole scene just worked really well. And, I loved how at the end of that scene, the whole sequence, grandpa's like, he's an idiot.
Yeah. You ever have a kid like that, I'll disown you. Yeah.
Yeah. So specific.
So not only that, I mean, the scene with the uncle in the crib, he's like, you better start getting used to these bars.
Yes.
Yeah. Everything, you know, every little bit of everything that was set up in that opening dinner scene.
Yeah.
Or the first act dinner scene is like paid off here in the second act dinner scene. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so good.
So is the implication that Lorraine was going to fall in love with just any boy that her dad happened to hit?
I think so.
I guess so.
Yeah. I think that's what it was.
So she like inherently has this kind of like mothering quality, right? Where she just like wants to save someone or, you know, protect someone or something like that. And it seems like that changes though when she's exposed to like the heroics of Marty McFly.
Yeah.
And that's becomes the thing that she craves. And it's like now like George has to live up to that.
I guess right. So. I mean, I thought it was just that she was like, you know, it's high school. It's puberty. She's yeah. just real horny. Because like before any heroics, yeah. like she's like all over Marty in the yeah, bedroom.
That's true.
You know? That's true. That's
true. She's like, dude, does everyone wear purple underwear? Like, you know. Yeah. And yeah, she's like immediately trying to jump his bones, like yeah. as soon as like Marty wakes up.
But I think she like really wants him more when he starts to stand up to Biff.
Yes.
Especially in that lunchroom scene. Where, you know, he like grabs him by the collar and lifts him up. I was like, damn, Marty. I remember as a kid thinking like, damn, man, he has like balls. Steel. Yeah. Holy crap.
And that's the interesting thing, because when Marty tries to push George onto Lorraine, she says, you know, she wants a real man.
Right.
It's because yeah. she's seen him stand up to Biff and do it in the most spectacular way possible. He yeah. invents skateboarding in the process of standing up to him, you know?
Yeah. And crash into manure.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this movie is that you think that Marty is the protagonist, and for, you know, he is the protagonist of this movie, but he's the kind of protagonist that's like, you know, there's two types of main characters in movie. There's two types of movies in like where the protagonist, there's one kind of movie where the protagonist is, you know, it's your typical hero's journey story where like they go on a journey and they change and they go through a character arc and have character development. Mm-hmm. They're changed by the end of it because of the world around them and the relationships he has. And then there's the kinds of movies where your protagonist is the force of change in the world. So like he's coming into the world and changing everything. You know, it's like Shawshank Redemption, like Andy Dufresne's your main character, but he's like the one changing all the prisoners and
yeah.
everything in that world. And he's staying pretty much the same from beginning right. to end. And that's the case here, I think, with Marty, is like everything that changes with him in the movie is not necessarily like a character change. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's he's changed the world around him. Like yeah. at the end, like he's changed his family,
yeah.
like the outcome of what his family becomes. And so in a way, it's like the other main character of this movie that is going through the change is George.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because he's coming into his life and changing George to become like, you know, more heroic, more courageous.
Right.
You know, grow some balls and become like a real dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because it's like a much more like active role that Marty's taking, because you see the problem in Marty's life in the first act.
Yeah.
It's his like his family's shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, his mom's a drunk.
Yeah.
His dad is like, you know, a nerdy loser.
Pushover.
Yeah. And, you know, his siblings suck because of it.
Yeah.
And like, it's a wonder how he turned out so like well-adjusted.
It's because he hung out with Doc Brown.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Doc Brown influence.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a result, like, it's like, then he finds the opportunity to change, you know, all the shit that was fucked up around him, like his family yeah. and everything, and change it. And that's kind of like the journey that he goes on. And, you know, it's got plenty of character development in the movie. It's just that character development is on George McFly rather than Marty, really.
Yeah. I mean, all of the, you know, you're right. Marty going back in time to the 50s, he is changing everyone around him, including Doc. He changes the circumstances of Biff along the way, obviously, who is washing cars now, you know.
Mr. McFly, your car's ready, sir. Your books arrived.
What an incredible payoff. Oh, my God. He the end of the movie is just like this, like perfect, like mid 80s, like Reagan era, like fantasy, like made manifest. He gets the car he wanted. The house is nice. Everyone's living their best life. It's so fantastic.
Which, by the way, that's a great fucking truck, by the way.
Just Yeah. It's great. It is.
Biff's transformation in the end, like the, what's his name? Thomas Wilson's transformation into that Biff is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I especially loved how, you know, when he, when George goes outside to check on the car, and he's doing the waxing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, and the first line, you kind of have like the old Biff still intact. He's like, oh, I'll just put in the second coat now. And then he's like, Biff, don't call me. And then he mentions like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mr.
You're right.
And I love that great piece of acting there by Thomas Wilson.
He's great in this movie. And I mean, like, I think too, because his character is so repulsive, but it's still funny. I mean, he's straight up like assaulting Lorraine in the car.
Oh yeah,
and it's awful. It's they go a little too far with it, but it's so goofy and he's so ridiculous that, you know, it's the cartoonishness of this movie, like, you know, once again at the forefront of the tone and all of that.
And that scene is like another bit of like perfect like Rube Goldberging.
Yes,
where it's like, you know, the whole setup is like Crispin Glover comes to like, you know, beat up Marty in this staged scenario. But then because Marty's like pulled out of the car like earlier, and then Biff is in there now. So like when Crispin Glover comes in and he's like, hey, get your damn hands off her. And like, and it's Biff. And it's like, now he like really has to like go through the change and become like the man that he's, you know, that he's going to be in the end. Whereas before it would have just been like this cheap, like, you know, oh yeah, okay. So like he pulled off this whole like act or whatever, but he wouldn't have really changed. So then like to get that switcheroo going on, it's like, it's funny and it's like, it's perfectly set up and paid off.
I mean, the look on Crispin Glover's face when he realizes it's Biff in the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see that moment where he's like, okay, I'm done. I give up, you know, but he goes for it. And it's one of the things that I also really love about this movie is that, you know, even though Marty is sort of the one, you know, like you said, changing everyone around him, it's ultimately like Lorraine that has to make the choice. Like, ew, this is gross. This feels wrong for some reason. And I don't know why. And, you know, George is the one that actually has to step up to Biff. So it's not just the fact that mom and dad are, you know, reunited and they're going to end up, you know, being together and all of that. Now I'm going to go back to a 1985 that's better. You know, now my dad's no longer going to be bullied. The bully's going to be the guy washing our car, you know, and all will be made right in the world. You know, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Okay, before we move on to awards and demerits, I just wanted to talk briefly about like some of the other things about this movie that I really love. Alan Silvestri's score is like one of the all-time best. I fucking love the score, man. So much.
Iconic. Yeah. And it was great how Zemeckis pretty much told Silvestri, you know, this is a low budget film for all intents and purposes. It wasn't a big budget.
Right.
It was really small. And so they were using every nickel and dime to make sure they got every, you know, everything on the screen. And I just love the fact that the story of Zemeckis telling Silvestri, just make it sound big, make it sound huge, make it sound epic, you know, and kudos to Silvestri because he really did a phenomenal job with that score.
Yeah, he did.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
And Huey Lewis, man.
And I was just going to say, I think the Huey Lewis needle drop in the opening scene is like top five favorite needle drops in the history of movies. It gets me pumped every single time I watch this movie. It's fucking great.
Just the power of love.
The second needle drop when Jennifer gives him the phone number.
Oh, that's the power.
Oh my God. It's amazing. It's so fucking good. But even down to like the marketing of this movie, from its iconic logo to its poster, like, I feel like you could, this movie is like one of those few like cinematic fetish objects, because everything about the film itself and everything around it is just like so amazing. I get immediate nostalgia when I see the poster or even the logo. There are very few movies like that.
Yeah.
Everything came together nicely for this film.
Yeah.
It was just like meant to be.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
It's definitely iconic.
Yeah.
It's like also like weirdly like, I don't know if this will make any sense to you guys, but it's like the most universal feeling movie of all time. Universal, like the studio, you know, because of both like, you know, from the ride at Universal, which was like one of my favorite rides of all time.
Love that ride as a kid,
you know, and like the music just screams Universal to me for some reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
The clock tower or like the whole like valley or the plaza. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, I've been to Universal Studios like a bajillion times and have gone on that tour. The backlot tour, like so many times, and like every time, like you pass by it, like that's what Universal Studios is to me. It's like that plaza. So like when you see it in the movie, you're like, Oh yeah, Universal Studios.
This movie is basically like a 2-hour commercial for Universal Studios because when I watch the movie, it makes me just want to go to Universal. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, good point, because the Clock Tower features like prominently in the tram tour. So
yeah,
it's great. All right, guys, let's move on to awards and demerits, starting with best object, weapon, or vehicle. Jules.
So I have had very little time to prepare for this episode because I've been super busy. So
do you want to go back in time and work on your category?
I've decided to do something, to try out something that probably would have made more sense last week, but as a tribute to our past Terminator series, I am just going to ask ChatGPT what I should pick for these categories. So, what is the best object, weapon, or vehicle from Back to the Future? Okay. the best item in Back to the Future is widely considered to be the time-traveling DeLorean DMC-12 car, which is transformed into a time machine by the character Doc Brown. The car's iconic design and central role in the story make it a popular and memorable aspect of the franchise. Good job. I agree, ChatGPT.
I feel a lot less original because I picked the same thing, although I don't know if there's really much else you could pick here.
I chose the flux capacitor.
Okay, I mean, which is...
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Oh.
When I was watching it again last night, I just loved the special effects, especially when it's reaching 88 miles per hour that first time, that first iconic shot. And you see it literally piercing the veil of time. You know, as you see little sparks going into that little wall, it's just mm-hmm. like the friction, causing the friction to go through it. I just thought it was really like a nice touch with the little details that I never noticed until when I watched it last night.
Yeah. And the like 80s practical effects of the whole thing, you know,
the flames.
88 miles per hour, which is infinity, you know, twice.
Yeah. So that's It's so neat. And like, you know, when it comes out the first time with Einstein and it's like, it's kind of frozen and, you know, like the smoke coming up and all of that. It's just, it's fucking great.
The best is like that first shot the first moment when they send the time machine through with Einstein, and like they're standing right in the way of the car, and Marty's like trying to run away, and Doc Brown like holds him in place, and it's like just before it hits them, it disappears, and it just becomes the flame tracks from the tire that goes right under between their legs. It's like, you know, another iconic shot of like those flames burning through between their legs.
And I love how Doc Brown is like, oh, you know, if my calculations are correct, this is going to work. But hey, make sure you don't get out of the way of this vehicle. Yeah. That's coming right towards you. You know, it's like, he's not even 100% sure it's going to work.
The one thing that I did find like off the remote control that Doc Brown uses to control the car.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's got a speedometer in the top left, and it's like rolling up to like 30 miles per hour while the car is stationary and the wheels are spinning.
Oh, right. I did notice that.
I was like, what the fuck? The car's not moving, but the thing is rolling up. And then I was like, maybe that's not the speedometer. Maybe that's something else. But then like it reads 88 as it like blasts through time. I was like, that was a speedometer.
I thought he was revving it up because he didn't have as much, I don't know, leeway or whatever for the car to go. And so the car spins for a while.
No, I understand that. But like the speedometer shouldn't be going up if it's stationary, even if the tires are rolling.
I guess that's true.
That's like Ferris Bueller, like throw the car in reverse logic.
I mean, no, you're definitely right. But I'm wondering if that ties into, again, like the bogus sci-fi of this movie.
Yeah, you know? It's definitely a cinematic effect.
Right.
To give the audience something to look at.
Yeah.
To like get them, you know, like, oh, crap, what's going to happen?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Before we move on, I just remembered, it's not the Nike Mags, but his Nike Blazers in this movie are like equally... Well, not equally, but it's like at least as iconic as like the fucking Kyle Reese shoes.
Yeah,
the white
with the red
Blazers with the red swoosh. That this movie like made the fucking Nike Blazers like extremely popular.
I bet.
And it's like it's a good looking shoe, you know. But especially in those colors, mm-hmm. the red, white, and like a little bit of blue on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oof, those are some spicy shoes.
What shoes did Doc have on?
I don't know, like those weird boots. No,
no, he was also wearing Nikes. Yeah,
oh shit,
I would have sworn.
Well, let's ask ChatGPT. what shoes is Doc Brown wearing in Back to the Future? In the Back to the Future trilogy, Dr. Emmett Brown, played by Christopher Lloyd, is mostly seen wearing tan work boots. So that's the answer I got from ChatGPT.
I'm looking at a picture right now, and it's at the Twin Pines Mall. He's wearing like these orange Nikes.
Let's see.
Interesting. I didn't notice.
Oh, they are they're an orange version of the Kyle Reese shoes, the Nike Vandal Highs.
Fucking Doc Brown.
There you go.
Trip out. Some style.
Styling it up, yeah. All right, best fight or action sequence, Julius.
The skateboard town chase.
Yeah, me too. I got the same thing. Yeah.
There's no question. I mean, it's cool from beginning to end. He steals the skateboard from the young kid.
Yeah.
As he's leaving, the young kid's like, screw that. Look at him go. Wow. Yeah, right. And also love the ending when he's in the ramen with the motor truck and he just runs across.
Oh my god, it's the coolest move ever when he does that shit. It's so cool.
With Silvestri's like, you know, yeah, music at high volume. It was like pitch perfect. And then the stop and they crash into the maneuver truck and perfect.
Shit. Perfect scene. And it's just like, you know, again, it's the setup payoff nature of this movie. Like, yeah, you've seen Marty, you know, riding around on a skateboard during the first act. So when he does that shit that pulls that move, you know, you're immediately in, you're sold, you know, and it's such a great payoff.
And I love that, you know, he started the whole like, whoa, what is that? What is that? And you sucker punch.
yeah, right.
Sucker punches and knocks him down and ran out. That's how you do it.
I mean, with a bully who's that size, you know, just picking on, you know.
You got to cheat.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, absolutely.
There's no rules in street fights.
Exactly. Jules.
ChatGPT agrees with you. The chase scene in which Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, races through the streets of Hill Valley on a skateboard while being pursued by Biff Tannen.
Perfect. Even AI knows.
Yep.
I'm starting to wonder if I'm very original in my thinking.
Yeah.
If
you know, it's figured us all out.
Yeah, exactly. This is some scary shit.
It could do our job for us.
It's going to run this podcast at a certain point.
Yeah, seriously. Just run our like voices through an AI model of our voice and then like have it read ChatGPT answers.
If it already knows what answers I'm going to give. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It might have a hard time with this one. Pitch me your Doc and Marty adventure, Jules, or ChatGPT.
Well, I've already typed it in. It is called Back to the Future Time Continuum Crisis.
Whoa.
The film takes place 30 years after the events of the original trilogy. Marty and Doc Brown have been working on a new time machine, but when they test it, they find themselves in a parallel universe where time travel is banned. The reason for this is a mysterious time anomaly that is causing the fabric of time to unravel, resulting in a crisis that threatens the existence of all realities. This is pretty good.
This is actually pretty good, yeah.
Marty and Doc must join forces with their counterparts in this alternate universe to track down the source of the anomaly and restore balance to time. Along the way, they encounter old friends and enemies, as well as new challenges and adventures. The film combines the signature humor and action of the original films with a fresh storyline and updated technology, while also paying homage to the beloved characters and moments. The rest of this is just like, you know, standard like pitch shit.
That's still pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But, yeah. There you go. The time continuum crisis.
Damn.
Yeah, that sounds pretty great. That puts my pitch to shame. Julius, what did you get?
I couldn't come up with anything.
Honestly. Oh, you didn't get anything? Okay.
I mean, the only thing that came to mind was Rick and Morty.
So, yeah,
I mean, they've literally already done any possible version.
That's the hard thing about this category, but I managed to come up with something, so bear with me. Doc and Marty travel to the year 2029, only to find out that the world has been devastated by nuclear war and the rise of artificial intelligence. They are immediately murdered by cyborgs who steal their time travel technology and use it to travel back in time to 1984 to kill Sarah Connor. There you have your Back to the Future and your Terminator spinoff.
Nice.
Crossover event.
If only Universal owned Terminator.
Hold on. I modified the question and added on, now give me a version where James Callahan is the villain. So this new version by ChatGPT is called Back to the Future, Callahan's Reckoning. In this sequel, Marty and Doc Brown are faced with their greatest challenge yet. A former Hill Valley police officer turned criminal mastermind, James Callahan. Callahan has acquired a time machine and is using it to alter key events in history for his own gain. Marty and Doc must travel through time to stop Callahan and restore the timeline. However, Callahan proves to be a formidable opponent who is always one step ahead.
Hell yeah.
Duo must use their wits, their knowledge of time travel, and their courage to stop Callahan and prevent a catastrophic chain of events that would have disastrous consequences for all of time.
I mean, that's amazing. I'm so glad they found a way to work me into the sequel.
And then, just real quick, I had it start writing out the script for a final set piece.
Uh-huh.
Exterior Hill Valley, 1985. Marty and Doc are seen racing through the streets in the time machine. I'll just give a snippet of this.
Yeah.
Being pursued by Callahan and his gang. Marty, breathing hard. Doc, we need to stop Callahan before he changes the timeline. Doc, I know, Marty, but he's always one step ahead of us. They approach the town square where Callahan and his gang are waiting for them. Callahan is holding the time displacement device, which he's using to manipulate the timeline. Callahan, laughing. Well, 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 look who's come to visit. The time travelers. Doc, determined. Not today, Callahan. Today we put an end to your evil plans. Callahan, menacing. You can't stop me, Brown. I have the power of time travel on my side.
Wow.
That's incredible. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah, it goes on for a while. Just some generic time travel battle.
This could be a cartoon series. I can see it as a cartoon series.
There you go. Callahan's Reckoning.
I love it. This one gets the pick. ChatGPT. Yeah, you outdid yourself. That's the one. That's the one. Okay. One retcon, Julius.
The keys. The one thing that's always bothered me about this film that I've noticed, and I asked a friend of mine who's a diehard Back to the Future fan to answer it, and even he couldn't answer it. And that is, how in the fuck did the keys of the band's car end up in the trunk when they threw Marty in there?
Huh.
Remember, they're like, the keys are in here. So I say that again. The keys, they're in here. So how in the fuck did you end up with the keys in the trunk? They never mention it. They never put a light on it. It was one of those things where I was like, wait, huh? Where do you get those keys from?
Yeah.
They were smoking weed in the car. Like, did they leave them in the trunk? Like, and how did Marty find them if they left them
was
in the trunk?
Well, the trunk was open, right?
Yeah.
It was open.
So maybe, like,
they left it open and left the keys there. They
left it,
like,
yeah. Because they just wanted to smoke a joint.
I mean, okay, all right, there you go. See, I didn't even think of that, but they're that stoned. Always bothered me. I was like, how the hell did the, what, huh?
Yeah.
How did he know the keys are in there?
It's because they're
funny
high.
Things happen when you're stoned. Yeah. I imagine they were just putting something away in the trunk, and they're like, let's smoke a bowl real quick before we go back on stage. They, like, set the keys down in the trunk because they're stoned.
Yeah.
They get in the car.
Dude, I'll never forget when I watched the movie again when I was 18. And I realized they were smoking weed for the first time. I was like, they were smoking weed this entire time? I thought they were smoking cigarettes this whole time. And I was like, dude, they went to a high school fucking dance. And fucking
In the 50s?
I was like, dude, holy shit.
Yeah, serious.
Holy mackerel. Okay, well, that's my only retcon, but now that you put it in perspective, I guess.
Good old Melvin Berry. Was it Melvin?
Jules, one retcon.
Let's see. One aspect of Back to the Future that some fans might choose to retcon is the treatment of certain characters and storylines. For example, some fans have criticized the portrayal of certain minority characters as stereotypical or one-dimensional, and might come to revise these elements to be more representative and nuanced. Additionally, the handling of certain time travel paradoxes, blah, 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 blah. Actually, that first point was actually interesting, ChatGPT, so good job there. But yeah, it kind of is, right? Like, you know,
to an extent,
the only black characters are like the stoners that are like fucking around, you know, at on a high school campus. But the one thing that I think is like a little bit more egregious, because that I don't really mind, but the thing that I find more egregious is this notion that the movie itself is trying to retcon history and make it so that a white dude invented rock and roll and not a black guy, Chuck Berry.
This is the one thing. Yeah. I know their hearts were in the right place with this. You know, this absolutely feels like a, you know, like proto Forrest Gump thing. You know, he was going to basically make a 2.5-hour movie out of this idea of somebody like, you know, coming in and actually inventing, you know, big historical moments. But yeah, I wish that they had just chosen a different song. It's great. Yeah. I love the scene, but the implications are terrible. And I even went, I even did some research to find out exactly when the song came out and if Chuck Berry wrote it. And yeah, it came out in 1958 and Chuck Berry wrote it. So like, I mean,
the implication that he stole it from a white guy is just like, let's not go there.
It's not great.
Like do a fucking Beatles song or a Rolling Stones song and have it be like, you know, hey, it's me. It's me, Mick, your cousin.
You would have to be a British person.
Oi, it's me, Mick. That was Australian.
Mate, you know that sound you're looking for, mate?
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. Okay, my one retcon is I would like to retcon any co-host retcons because Back to the Future is perfect. So, okay, we're going to move on.
Fair enough.
Including ChatGPT.
Okay, so you think it's fine that Chuck Berry stole... Chuck Berry is just a thief to steal songs.
Who stole Marty McFly's song.
From a white guy.
He wrote other songs. He wrote other great songs. He's fine. Okay, Golden Cannon Award. Jules.
One behind-the-scenes crew member who deserves a shout-out for their contributions to the Back to the Future franchise is composer Alan Silvestri. Yeah, good point. Silvestri's musical score for the films perfectly captures the mix of humor, excitement, and heart that defines the franchise, and his iconic theme for Back to the Future is instantly recognizable and beloved by fans. Well, there you go.
Dude, fuck that GPT chat. Fuck that Terminator shit. That was my pick. Alan Silvestri's score was my pick. It's so weird, dude. It's so fucking trippy.
There you go. It's got us pegged. We're too predictable. You know?
Dude. Oh my God. Man. But I mean, how can you not notice the score? That's like, you know, that's the one thing anyone can hum it. If you hum it today, people will recognize it.
Yeah.
It's showcasing like his skills. And, you know, I was so happy that he got to score the Avengers movies because he did create another iconic score for that.
Did he do the Avengers
score? I love his score for the Avengers movies.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Though, and you know, that's the thing about Marvel. They rarely have like good scores, but the Infinity War and Endgame scores are pretty great.
They're great.
Yeah, Sylvester did great with that stuff.
Yo, Black Panther score, Ludwig Göransson.
Yeah, that was Göransson, right?
You said every Marvel score. Yeah.
Right. I'm there's like 50 Marvel movies, okay? And like 5 of them have good scores, all right? So
for Avengers, for me, Avengers was the most notable and noticeable score.
Yeah.
Kind of differentiated itself from the rest of the, like the, I don't know, for me, I found the Marvel scores to be kind of bland and like...
They're deeply generic, yes.
Yeah, generic.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Avengers, the first one, I was like, ooh, I like that one.
Yeah, it has like memorable themes.
It has a motif.
And then when I saw his name, I was like, oh, of course.
Exactly.
It's actually perfect.
He also did the music for Ready Player One. And I actually really like the music in that. It has a very classic 80s, obviously, you know, 80s feel to it. And, you know, it features the DeLorean.
I actually really don't remember the music from Ready Player One at all.
I mean, I've seen the movie a few times. So, like, I've always had, like, a soft spot for that movie.
I've seen that movie exactly Ready Player One time.
And a lot of people would argue that that's even too many times. So, you know,
everyone's... I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for
what
it was.
Yeah. Okay. Wait, did I give my golden cannon? No.
I don't think you gave yours. No.
Is it the same?
No, my golden cannon is Zemeckis and Gale for the script. Because I just
this good pick.
Perfectly good pick. Constructed piece of writing.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, best quote or character moment, Julius.
I love the introduction of Marty and Doc in 1955 and how he has that mind reader machine.
Oh, yeah.
He tries to like figure out what he's thinking.
Yeah.
And then when he tells him the whole story about who he is, how he got there,
mm-hmm.
and then he's like, "Do you realize what this means? They mean this machine doesn't work at all." And he's like running away to the other part of the house. And then I just loved how he, you know, writes him off, you know, good luck, future boy, goes back into his laboratory. And then Marty just lays out exactly how he got the injury in his forehead.
Yep.
And I just love the ending where you just hear the locks just, and then Christopher Lloyd walking out like, what the fuck?
That like, face that. He makes.
Yeah.
I mean,
perfect.
There's a 5 minute stretch over the course of like these sequences where Christopher Lloyd gives like an Oscar worthy performance.
Yeah.
Like his physical comedy is incredible. That visual gag where it's like, it looks like he's consulting somebody like a mentor, but he's talking to a picture of Thomas Edison.
Yeah.
Funny. When he's like asks who the president is.
21 gigawatts.
When he asks who the president is and it's Ronald Reagan. And oh my God. It's such a.
The actor.
Yeah.
I bet John Wyman. It's the first lady.
Okay. Jules, best quote or character moment.
One of the most iconic and frequently quoted lines is, "Where we're going, we don't need roads." Doc Brown.
Son of a bitch, that's what I picked.
Oh, no way! Oh, dude! I was hoping we'd finally be able to stump it. Damn it.
We have not stumped
it. It's such a generic one, James. You can do better than
that. No. I know it's generic, but I actually have a lot to say about it. Because first of all, I think it is like the greatest final line in a movie. I think it's that line and "I'm finished" from There Will Be Blood are like the best two final lines in the history of movies. I also love the kind of like tongue-in-cheek quality of the movies, like shamelessly setting itself up for a sequel, even though like Zemeckis and Gale have said that they didn't mean it to be a setup for a sequel. It's just like, oh yeah, the adventures are just going to keep coming if it's time travel. You know, they're just going to keep doing this.
Right.
So I kind of love the idea that like they kind of threw that in there as a way to like just, you know, get the audience pumped when they were walking out of the theater, you know, ready to recommend it to everybody that they knew. And then it kind of came back to haunt them when, you know, they were told, you guys have to do a sequel because we're going to do it whether you guys are involved or not. So I feel like they kind of, by throwing that ending in there, they kind of, you know, suddenly kind of created the same sort of like paradox for themselves where they're like, oh shit, the only way to get out of this is to actually like make a sequel that finishes this story completely,
right.
You know, so.
And that was in 89 when they started working on the sequels?
They shot them in 89, I believe. And
both
and
back part, to back, right?
Yeah, part two came out in 89 and part three came out in 90. And the DeLorean itself kind of becomes this sort of like object that they're trying to destroy, which I think is like a fun metaphor for the franchise itself. You know, this is one of the rare canons that's like a closed loop because they were like insistent that they could never make sequels or spinoffs to this. So,
right.
Which I have a lot of respect for.
Also symbolically, the DeLorean company too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you guys ever heard of the inventor of that car, like his backstory.
John DeLorean?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Like a huge shithole.
What a fascinating character.
But hey, the DeLorean's a cool looking car. I heard it didn't run very well. It was kind of a piece of shit.
Yeah, I heard it broke down a shit ton of times.
Yeah. Okay, best character overall, Jules.
The best character in Back to the Future is a matter of personal opinion, but the main protagonist, Marty McFly, is widely considered to be one of the franchise's standout characters, played by Michael J. Fox. Marty is a relatable and likable hero who finds himself transported through time and facing a variety of challenges. His wit, resourcefulness, and bravery make him a beloved character for many fans.
I feel like ChatGPT broke Breaking Canon because I picked Marty McFly.
No way. Oh, my God.
And I
what
actually,
an unoriginal choice, James.
I consider... Look, I actually kind of didn't want to pick him, but then I was thinking about the entire trilogy, and I was like, this is probably the point where I'm going to want to do it because I think that he's like at his absolute best and most iconic in this movie. So, and also I just like, Michael J. Fox's performance, I already said it, is just, it's so incredible. He is so funny in this movie. His timing, his delivery, his physical comedy, just, you know, like all of the different things that he does, you know, like the way he reacts to things when he almost gets hit by a car, or like when he falls over himself trying to put his pants on in Lorraine's room, just like things like that that are just so funny, you know. And yeah, so it's Marty, who was always like the coolest character to me. Him and John Connor, two like most iconic characters to me as a kid.
If I wasn't so committed to this bit, I probably would have gone with Crispy Glover, but
that's true because no one's going to get a chance to do that in the future movies. So, yeah.
You know, what can you do?
Julius, what'd you pick?
Biff Tannen.
That's a great pick.
Biff.
He just like love to hate character. Yeah. The Thomas Wilson, just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
I love how he made him like a true bully and tough, but also kind of dumb too.
Yeah, totally. The
sayings like, man, why don't you make like a tree? And get out of here. Just like things like he brought so much to the table, and it's a shame that he didn't have a bigger career, acting career, mm-hmm. after the movie.
Yeah,
but I would imagine he was probably typecast as that character, or everyone just remembered him as that character, like the Luke Skywalker effect for Mark Hamill. You know,
yeah,
you're always seen as that character, and that's it. But yeah, Biff Tannen, man, was my pick overall because I love seeing the blue collar pre 1955 Biff, you know, this continuation of the bully, and now he's a blue collar bully. Like,
yeah.
Where are my reports? You know, like I gotta have time to like rewrite it, you know, that kind of deal. And then you see him as a bully, and then you see him as this like meek, like, oh, you know, like,
yeah, totally. Can you imagine being bullied by the same person for 30 years?
Oh, that'd be like hell, dude.
Yeah.
That'd be fucking hell.
And they are kind of in hell, you know, when the movie opens. So, you know,
yeah, it
makes sense. A hell of their own making. This is what happens if you never stick up for yourself. This is what your world is going to be, you know.
Oh, dude.
Okay, best scene. Jules.
The best scene in Back to the Future is a matter of personal opinion, but one of the most memorable and iconic scenes is the opening sequence in the first film when Marty McFly first discovers the time machine. This scene sets the stage for the rest of the film and establishes the key elements of the franchise, including the time machine, the relationship between Marty and Doc, and the sense of excitement and adventure that runs throughout the series.
Oh man, I almost picked that.
Did you?
Well, but
the scene features Doc Brown's dramatic demonstration of the time machine and Marty's reaction to it, making it a standout moment in the franchise.
Wow. Julius, what'd you get?
I did not get that. I got George knocking out Biff.
Oh yeah, it's a great moment.
I know.
It was so satisfying to watch. You know, the whole build up before that, you know, him bullying them in the beginning when Marty first goes to 1955, and then embarrassing him in front of everybody when it was a packed house and in the cafe. He's gonna pretty much shake him down. To have him just finally knock him out, especially after he physically put his hands on Lorraine. And then him just getting that courage up and just knocking him up with one punch. Like, it was pretty cool. It was pretty like, yeah, hell yeah, finally threw some balls.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Knocked him out, one punch. And it's funny, it's so funny to me when they're dancing afterwards and they immediately ask him if he wants to be school president.
Yeah, right.
You knocked out the bully, you want to be school president? Yeah.
I love the moment when he's starting to put his hands on Lorraine and his like goons are like hanging back and he's like, this ain't no peep show, get out of here, guys. Dude, like it's so disgusting.
Yeah.
But yeah,
you mean
yeah.
Billy Zane?
Yeah. One of them is Billy Zane himself. Yeah. Okay, so I picked for best scene. I picked the finale. Like the whole bit of, you know, the clock tower, you know, the lightning bolt going back to 1985.
Ooh, yeah.
But specifically, like, I think the most like cathartic moment of this movie, like the moment that pays off the most for me is when Doc reveals the bulletproof vest and the letter that you saw Marty write just like, you know, 20 minutes ago. And now it looks like it's 30 years old. And it's such a like a giddy feeling, you know, of like, oh, they did it. They fucking landed this ship, you know, and it's such a great moment. And it also made me think about their friendship again, because in a way, Now that Marty has revealed to Doc how time travel works, he doesn't have to wait 30 years to do it. He doesn't actually have to wait to meet Marty, right? You know what I mean? From 1955 to 1985.
Right.
He's seen the flux capacitor. He's seen the DeLorean. He knows what he needs to do this. So you'd think like, well, you could do this in 15 years, right? You don't have to squander your fortune to do this. But he chooses to do all of that because of his friendship with Marty, so that they'll still meet and they'll still do all of these things and remain friends at the end of it. And I think that's like, I don't know if that was intended by the writers, but it's my read on the movie, and it makes me like really value their friendship even more.
And there's like the little things where he says, like when Doc is about to take off into the future and Marty's like, hey, look me up when you get there, will you?
Yeah.
It's like so good.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's that genuine friendship that comes through. You're just like, you know, it's beautiful.
It's because I think we are like conditioned today to look at something like this and immediately pick it apart. If we like, you know, like you were saying, Jules, if we saw this in a movie today, we would think like, you know, it'd raise some eyebrows. But like, it's such a sincere like friendship. And you can tell that was not the intent at all to make it weird in any way. It's one of the things I love about this movie, and like how kind of like, even though it's so perfectly constructed, it still has so much goofiness to it and the performances and the characters. And yeah, like I remember even as a kid, like always kind of wondering why they were friends, but over time, like really appreciating that friendship and this like sort of like inexplicable bond that they have.
What if it turns out like Doc Brown really is like abusing the shit out of Marty, and Marty just has like Stockholm syndrome. Yeah.
it's because
he really is a good guy, I swear.
It's because Biff abused his dad, so like he's like attracted to abusers, and
it's a cycle. It's a cycle.
All right, guys, final thoughts and personal rating. Julia, start us off.
Yeah, a timeless classic for sure. I think anyone today can watch this and enjoy it the same way someone from 1984 or 85, whenever the movie was originally released, enjoyed it. And the reason why I say that is because I remember my little niece, when she turned 10, she was introduced to the movie. Her mom had watched it for the first, and she had watched it for the first time. And like literally months later, she watched it almost every day.
Nice.
That's how much she enjoyed it, you know? And it surprised me. I was like, wow, I can't believe like she would actually like come home from school, do her homework, and after she was done with the homework, she put on the movie and watch it again.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that I guess the story is so simple that a child can follow it and enjoy it.
Yeah. And it appeals to all ages, you know?
Yeah,
it has that kind of comfort food kind of feel to it that, you know, I think anybody can enjoy, anybody can understand. And it's such a delight, you know, from start to
finish. Well written, well paced. Yeah. Everything just works so well and everything fell into place. And it's one of those movies that like a lightning in the bottle, kind of like Star Wars. It just blew up. It just worked. Everything just worked. So for me, it's a 10. It's pure Americana 80s cinema at its finest.
Jules.
Many film critics and fans rate Back to the Future Part 1 as a solid 9 out of 10, and it continues to enjoy a strong cult following to this day. Agree with that. It's a 9 for me. It's a good movie. It grows on me every time I watch it, like I said. And, you know, I didn't start out loving the movie as a kid, but you know, it's grown on me so much, and this time especially watching it, I was really impressed at just how well everything works and fits together.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny. Like the characters are so lovable, and there's like, you know, a really strong like good like friendship dynamic, like this bromance between the two, mm-hmm. which I fucking love. Yeah, I'm excited for the next movie, especially because I it's the one that has like all the cool like future-y stuff that as a kid I really I think the second one is the one that I like was wanting, you know, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. all the future stuff,
totally.
Like the hover skateboards and whatever. So I'm excited to see how that holds up. And the third one, I've never actually seen all the way through. I've attempted to watch the third one several times, and I don't think I've stayed awake through the entirety of the movie.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm a sleepy guy when I watch
movies. Yeah, for sure.
It's no knock on the movie, I don't think, but maybe it is. I don't know.
I'm excited. That movie actually has a kind of like chill vibe. I could see just like, it's a Western. Yeah, it's agreed. Got a warm,
little nap time movie.
Yeah. It's a nap time movie, I think.
Nap time movie.
Yeah.
Okay. A classic NTM.
Yeah.
But yeah, for this one, solid 9 out of 10.
Solid.
And it
nine.
Continues to enjoy a strong cult following to this day.
I mean, I don't know about cult following ChatGPT. This is like, remains like one of the most popular movies of all time. And, just like, checking IMDb, Letterboxd, and, all the various sites, like it's one of the most highly rated movies out there.
Oh, no. I think it means that it started a cult, a literal cult of followers,
right.
And
older men hanging out with teenage boys.
Interesting. Yeah.
The dark legacy of Back to the Future. Yeah.
We don't want to talk about it. Yeah. We don't like to talk about it, but it's.
I will say when I go to the Comic Cons, it's cool to see everyone, the people who bring their DeLoreans decked out in Back to the Future stuff on them. It's so it's so cool.
Yeah,
badass.
I don't think I've ever seen one in person. I need to change that.
Oh, they're great. Dude, they fix them up nice, man. Yeah. They take care of those cars.
Yeah.
They take them, they show them off, and it drives. They drive and they travel and stuff. So it's like, that's cool, dude, that they're able to do that.
And are they just always like queuing up Huey Lewis when, they pull?
Some do.
Okay, good.
Some do.
Right. They have to do that. They have to do that. Yeah.
You got to.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like I'm so glad that you guys are so positive on this movie, because it is impossible for me to be objective about this film. I just think it's perfect. I have no complaints about it. I mentioned it's comfort food. It's a go-to favorite I put on a lot, and it always puts me in a good mood. And that's the thing I think I love the most about this movie, is that no matter what, I can put this movie on and it will instantly put me in a good mood. And I think that's what this movie kind of represents to me, in addition to all of its other achievements, beyond all of that, I could just put this movie on at any time and enjoy it. So it's going to be a 10 out of 10 for me, which is going to bring our average to a 9.7, which is, still pretty high.
Yeah.
But it's not a perfect 10.
No.
No. Listen, I reserve my 10s for movies like Terminator 2 and Terminator Genesis. Yeah, right.
And episodes of Andor, and that's it.
Every episode of Andor. Yeah, exactly.
Howard the Duck, Genesis, and T2. That's all. T2. The only things that are 10s. Yeah.
And every episode of Andor.
Fair enough. I mean, I do kind of look at, like, it's very interesting that Empire and T2 are like our only 10 out of 10 movies. To this day. And I thought there was a chance we could do it with this one. I'm not bummed or anything that we didn't, but
damn,
it makes
you,
me wonder,
GPT.
It makes me wonder, like, when we'll get another 10 out of 10, like a full Breaking Canon average 10 out of 10. So we'll have to see.
Well, maybe when we get to the Austin Powers trilogy.
If
three Obi straight Dane. 10 out of 10s.
If.
Three straight 10 out of 10s across the board.
Baby.
God.
It's my favorite scene. This wig will come.
Well, that'll wrap up our discussion of Back to the Future. If you would like to support our show, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Breaking Canon Podcast and Twitter at Break Canon Pod. Special thanks to Brian Wood for our music. On the next episode of the podcast, we are traveling to the year 1989 for a discussion of Back to the Future Part 2. Until then, thanks for breaking canon with us, and we'll see you next week.